Our final case today is Fisher against Barnhart. Mr. Rose.
If it please the court, counsel. I represent the appellant in this matter. Mr. Fisher presents a rather unusual, but I think essentially a simple case for this court to decide. There was a hiatus in his work history. That hiatus was recognized by the administration as exceeding the duration rule requirement, so that he, during the period of his lack of work, his unemployment, he was at that time, arguably, the condition that he met that he had, arguably met the listing 12.05C. That particular listing combines two conditions. The one is cerebral palsy. I believe that there is no question that Mr. Fisher had cerebral palsy for many, many years. The other criterion was an IQ of 70 or less. In addition, there was the additional requirement of that listing is that the cerebral palsy, or it doesn't say cerebral palsy per se, but it says cerebral palsy that, or a condition that severely affects their ability to work. Both of those conditions were in evidence in the medical record, and the attorney at the administrative level argued for that meeting of that listing. The claimant, Mr. Fisher, argues that the ALJ erred because instead of addressing the question as to whether or not Mr. Fisher's condition met or equaled the listing 12.05C, rather the ALJ simply adopted the findings of the state agency physicians, the DDS physicians, who had opined that he was not disabled. The ALJ did not undertake any kind of analysis or explanation of his own. Now, it is obvious that in the record itself, for example, at the administrative record at page 170, the state agency's own records reflect that they knew that he had a IQ of 70, and that obviously he also, their records indicated that he had cerebral palsy. It's also interesting to observe that another listing, namely a listing 11.07 capital A, is not even as intricate as 12.05C. 11.07A simply says, if you have cerebral palsy and you have an IQ of 70 or less, you meet the listing. And there's nothing about whether there's whether the cerebral palsy has any effect upon your ability to work. Now, the issue that I believe is rather simple is that it is the ALJ's responsibility ultimately to draw the ultimate conclusions in these cases. His decision, when it is rejected by the Appeals Council, it becomes the final decision of the commissioner, as this court well knows. So that, therefore, it is simply plain error for the ALJ to say, I will adopt the decision of the DDS, the state agency physicians, without analyzing anything whatsoever, and dismiss the case. And he does all of this in about one paragraph of his decision. Most of the decision is devoted to an establishing that prior to and after the hiatus to which I have referred, the Mr. Fisher was conducting SGA, that is substantial gainful activity. Accordingly, we believe that it was also error. It was plain error for the ALJ not to do some kind of analysis to show why the claimant did not meet 1205C or 1107A, but also it was error for him to proceed on in the sequential evaluation process to go on to step four and talk about step four, that that Mr. Fisher was capable of performing his past work, since his past work and his new work on either side of this hiatus was basically the same. We believe that the job that he had both before and after this hiatus was an accommodated job. And the proof of that is that the vocational expert at the hearing stated in so many words that that was the case, that he did not meet the criteria of the Dictionary of Occupational Titles for a computer operator. And so the VE called him a computer operator helper, whatever that might mean. Accordingly, that is our case. And if the court has no questions, I would reserve my
rest. What significance do you attach to the fact that his salary was $48,000 a year? That doesn't sound like the salary that would be best understood as charity.
No, it was not.
The amount of money you make from, well, dare I say it, substantial gainful employment.
Yes, we're saying that we're not arguing that he was not undertaking substantial gainful activity both before and after this hiatus period. The hiatus period was in excess of 12 consecutive months. What we're saying is during that closed period, and that's the only claim that Mr. Fisher is laying for benefits, is a closed period of disability for this one period of time. It's about 17 months.
We're aware of this, but this isn't addressing my question.
Well, he wasn't making anything during that period of time.
No, counsel, my question is, your whole position boils down to the claim that his employment both before and after this 17-month period was the equivalent of charity or a sheltered workshop rather than substantial gainful activity. And the question I had for you is, how is that consistent with the fact that he earned $48,000 a year? That doesn't look like the wages paid in a sheltered workshop or charitable employment.
The criterion is not that he has to work in a sheltered workshop or something of that nature, where it is, in fact, charity or some kind of government-subsidized employment, such as doors or something like that. What we're saying is that any kind of employment which can be construed on the basis of substantial evidence as being accommodated means that he is...
An accommodation is a form of charity.
Well,
and my question is, how is that consistent with the size of his income? That looks like an income that one gets from actual doing real work.
Well, I'm not saying he wasn't doing real work, but what he was doing was something that was not ordinarily available to persons of his condition in the national economy in significant numbers. So I would...
Yes.
Unless there are other questions, I would
thank
reserve
you, Mr.
any.
Rose.
Thank you.
Mr. Dale.
May it please the court, Yusef Dale on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security Administration. Your Honors, this panel should affirm the ALJ's decision, because at step three, substantial evidence supported the ALJ's finding that plaintiff did not meet listing 12.05C. I want to be clear about this. There are two requirements that plaintiff has to satisfy to meet this listing. He didn't talk about the first one, which is in the diagnostic description of the introductory paragraph. He has to show that he is actually mentally retarded. He never made that showing, never even attempted to make the showing. He made the showing in Section C, that is the IQ of 70 and the significant other severe impairment, cerebral palsy, but he never showed he was mentally retarded. And in fact, the evidence shows that he was not mentally retarded. How do we know this? The ALJ, first of all, adopted the opinion of the state agency reviewing physician as opposing counsel has stated, That was from Dr. Henson. Dr. Henson reviewed all of the psychological medical evidence of record. He specifically cited from that evidence in his decision. He specifically considered whether plaintiff met 12.05C, and after reviewing the evidence, in particular the two reports from when plaintiff was a youth, and after reviewing the other evidence, he came to the sound, unequivocal opinion that plaintiff did not meet the requirements of listing 12.05C. And the ALJ adopted that finding, as opposing counsel has alluded to. What could be more reasonable than that? The ALJ, consistent with this court's repeated admonitions that ALJs not play doctor, he did not play doctor. Rather, he looked to the opinion of a doctor who had reviewed all of the evidence and came to that conclusion. Nothing is more reasonable than that. Moreover, the evidence itself certainly confirms the accuracy of Dr. Henson's opinion and, by extension, the ALJ's adoption of that opinion. Psychologist Zewitt specifically says these tests indicate learning disability, not mental retardation. She goes on to point to another subtest, which also, she says, indicates scores, quote, much higher than one would expect from somebody who's mentally retarded. No showing of mental retardation whatsoever. The ALJ adopted the opinion of Dr. Henson, as I've pointed to, and there's nothing more reasonable than that. Moving on to plaintiff's argument regarding RFC, first of all, plaintiff has thoroughly and unequivocally waived all of the arguments that he raises in his brief, never even mentions RFC in his brief, never even mentions substantial gainful activity in his district court brief, that is, waived those arguments completely. And as Your Honor has pointed out, this case comes down to whether that work was substantial gainful activity. Plaintiff has admitted it's substantial gainful activity before and after the period. The ALJ found that plaintiff could have returned to that past relevant work. Plaintiff did return to that past relevant work. Therefore, it's really undisputed whether plaintiff could have done that work. He certainly did it. He certainly returned to it. And is it substantial? Certainly it is. As Your Honor has indicated, he earned $48,000. He received training on the mainframe system specifically for this job. He testified that he took two courses to perform this job. He also testified that he did the job well, and he testified that he had no problems doing the job. It was definitely substantial. 17 years, full-time employment, no question about it. This case is clear, and is barring any questions from the panel, we would ask that this court affirm the ALJ's decision. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Rose?
Just 3 points, Your Honor.
In my brief, Your Honor, I addressed the question of the mental retardation. 1205C contains its own definition of mental retardation, and we believe that the medical evidence presented by Mr. Fisher conforms to that definition. Secondly, the ALJ has the responsibility of resolving conflicts. He doesn't ever mention 11.07, capital A. He is the one who has to decide the issue. That is something that is also reversible, I think. Finally, I would appeal to Wilder versus, I think it's Wilder versus Opfel, it's in my brief, that a claimant can be employed, yet unemployable. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.